stocks taking a wild ride with chaotic swings and two 1,000-point drops this week.
We just ran in a circle, turned around, smacked into a wall, and then bounced. It's a reversal of fortune. The Dow swinging at breakneck speeds.
Wow. Whiplash on Wall Street as stocks make more dramatic moves, capping off a wild week of a ton of volatility. The worst week for the Dow and the S&P in more than 2 years.
We had more than a 1,000-point swing top to bottom today, and we ended up 331 points. But we had the biggest sell-off twice in points this week.
When you see a day where the markets are up and down thousands of points intraday over periods of time, it's trading in wild technical moves, 200-day moving average, buying and selling, there's nothing I can say except it's going to be another volatile week next week.
Woo!
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
What a week this was, with stocks gyrating every single day, including 1,000-point swings and 1,000-point losses, including this Friday, where we saw a 1,000-point swing from the lows of the day to where we ended up and finished. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray will be joining us. He's still bearish in terms of where this stock market correction will need to go. He thinks we're going to go down even further. You want to hear why he feels that way. Now, remember, this was a guy that was very bullish and nailed it in terms of where the S&P was going to go. He'll be joining me. Kurt Wolf will also join me in the latter part of the hour as we talk about oil prices, where they're heading, oil stocks, and what happened, and how overplayed this has become. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about the events shaking the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Jim is right. From reaching record levels in January, stock prices have plunged globally. Not just stock prices. It's almost every asset class, from stocks and bonds and commodities. And this is a notable plunge from all of the euphoric highs in January. It all happened in almost just a week's time. So what does all of this mean? Is it some radical shaking event, or is it a correction and establishment of a new paradigm? That will be the subject of preoccupation and investment advice coming up in the second hour of the program in the Big Picture, as the Financial Sense News Hour just gets underway here today. And first, to see what's going on Wall Street and elsewhere of investment implication, is Ryan Poplava. And Ryan slept pretty much through the whole week. Nothing out of the ordinary, right? So,
nothing happened this week. Let's just move on to the technical analyst?
Nothing to see here. Jedi mind trick, right? So the big question on everybody's mind, Ryan, is why? I mean, why did the stock market correct as much and as fast as it did in the past week, especially when you were considering the highs that we hit in January and the euphoria that we've been in over the last year?
Yeah, up 7%. And as I mentioned in a couple of our podcasts and to our listeners, that, you know, this is what a bull market feels like. You know, we were definitely in quite a bit of that. And is it completely over? I don't think so. This is a typical bull market correction. But, you know, before, when I used to enter in trades manually, I just want to state this because it puts things into perspective a little bit. 20 years ago, I used to hand print out every little trade ticket we did for clients. I used to have, if we wanted to go into one stock, I'd have around 300 of these little trade tickets hand printed. And each time we would put those in individually for our clients, I'd timestamp them, run them through a little machine, and it would hit. And that used to be my whole day. If we wanted to buy one stock, good riddance on doing anything else. I'm printing these things out. But John, these days, with the systems that we have in place, it's easy with a trading system and an operational managing system for this stuff to essentially, and also you take into consideration the advent of ETFs, it's very easy to fully liquidate a portfolio in less than a minute, John. And then I can do that across millions upon millions. And imagine the large hedge funds with billions. So speed is not an issue these days. So when we see these fast moving markets, they happen. I remember in 2010, the flash crash, same situation. Program trading kicked in. You know, we hit these stops, stop limits trigger, and that triggers just a flow of volume. So what was out of the ordinary, John, was 311 days without a 3% correction in the stock market. That was out of the norm. So you asked me why. You know, why do we have this correction? There's truly no satisfying reason I can give that would say, okay, yeah, I totally agree with that. That makes sense. You know, I've heard headlines and articles from chief investment officers, from the media, from bloggers, and the consensus view right now is investors are repricing the risk of higher rates. I've been talking about higher rates since the beginning of January. I've been talking about wage inflation, hourly wage inflation, as we looked at the job reports from December as well as January. But I also mentioned last week, look at the CPE data figures that showed inflation year over year is only up 1.5% in January. So yes, this is a situation and the market is adjusting to it. That's not the cause of this correction. In my opinion, it was merely a price correction, a technical correction. Fundamentals had nothing to do with it. Yes, we are overpriced. We've been overpriced for a year. So anybody can point at valuations and say, yeah, that's why. Market was elevated. We started selling off, you know, Friday, February 2nd because of that. No, but like I said, it's not the root cause. It's ancillary. Earnings are projected to increase anywhere between 16 to 20% based on what metric company you follow. I follow FactSet. Last I looked, it was 16%. I mentioned that last week. Economic results are strong, John. The ISM services ticked up in January. That was announced on the day the Dow fell 1,600 points. So it's not fundamentals that's causing this. It's purely technical, purely volatility, purely price. And if you look at how the correction has proceeded, everything has been technical with an acceleration in the selling pressure as key metrics like the 50-day moving average on Monday were breached and broken and couldn't hold. And I'd look today on Friday, I was following 2620 on the S&P. That was a number that we fell through at the last hour of the day on Thursday, rallied, couldn't hold that on Friday morning and fell precipitously out throughout the day. And guess where we stopped? The 200-day moving average within just a few points. The last I looked at it, that number was 2539. Today's low, 2532. So, you know, Hyman Minsky, he once said, stability leads to instability. And that's what we had here.
Yeah. I mean, it was indeed a Minsky moment. You know, who was Minsky anyway? That we're here.
He's an economist, had a lot to say. He wrote a book in the 1980s about bubbles, etc. He really became famous actually in the financial crisis in 2008. A lot of people were talking about what you just said, you know, a Minsky moment.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought I'd mention it so people would know what we're talking about right here. All right. So you do believe that this was a purely technical correction. No event drove fear into the market. It was purely a reaction to the price volatility and a break in trend. Stop loss is probably triggered as the moving averages broke down. What about some of the other issues like the spike in the VIX, the effect that had on volatility inverse funds like the one managed by Credit Suisse in which trading was halted and then they had to close down the fund?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I believe that inverse volatility funds and hedge funds that apply similar strategies. The situation was more an effect than a cause of the correction. Like Warren Buffett says, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. You know, the recent market event caused some dislocations in the fund given that what happened on Monday. Volatility was up 115%. So if your fund is designed to go up, if volatility goes down a certain percent and to match that, what happens on the opposite? And again, what happens when the volatility goes up 115%? Does the inverse of that go down? So do you go down 115%? You can't and still have a net asset value at the end of the day. Interestingly, ProShares short VIX is still open. And even though it opened the following day, it was down like 80%. To me, risk parity is a little bit of a bigger issue. And there's perhaps, last I checked from an article I read from the Financial Times, it said there was around $400 billion in assets in this style of investing. But the thought process behind risk parity has actually really been around forever since there's kind of been a portfolio allocation theory. Risk parity is a strategy that evens out risk contributions from all the different major asset classes. So you have a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. It's diversification. Ray Dalio's all-weather portfolio is very similar in that it was designed to have a portion of the portfolio do well no matter the economic scenario, with allocations in all asset classes based on risk tolerances. So if you started feeling that risk was going up in equity markets, then what do? You lower your allocation to equities. You start pairing into, let's say, treasuries. So essentially, as fear has gripped the market this week, volatility spiked in equities, and it causes those portfolio managers to readjust their assumptions on risk and therefore their allocations towards each other, towards each of these positions, possibly rotating out of equities as the risk for them goes up. So that's a really complicated way of saying that, hey, risk went up, market went down, so the manager started selling. And so I think everyone's been kind of gravitating towards, we got to have a reason why. It's got to look intelligent. So let's use big words like risk parity and inverse volatility funds. No, that's not the cause. That's, as I said, you know, Warren Buffett looking at when the tide goes out, you discover who's been swimming naked. And that's what happened this week in those inverse volatility funds.
Okay. All right. Well, volatility is finally here. It's probably safe to say investors in the market had become complacent towards it with, as you mentioned last week, 311 days since we had previously experienced a 3% dip in stock. So, Ryan, the economy continues to muddle along. I mean, there were some events this week and the earnings season is still in session. So let's jump over to that. Jim Poplavo and I are, by the way, going to go into that in depth in the big picture. So we're not done with this topic and everything. But let's go over to, let's see, earnings season. Did they add or detract from this week's correction?
No, I mean, it's an individual stock story right now. The main story is the market falling. It eclipsed everything. But there were certain days, like you look at Twitter, was up 20-something percent. And at one point, I think it closed only up 12, I think, on Thursday. NVIDIA increased its earnings and outlook for this quarter, for the first quarter of this year already. As I mentioned, you know, fact set last week, earnings are expected to grow 16% this year. So no, things look great on earnings. And why wouldn't they? The fiscal stimulus that they're going to experience this year is phenomenal. And I've been speaking about that all month. And this, obviously, the price action this week is going to eclipse that, but it's been great. Economics continue to be strong. The ISM services survey, as I already mentioned, on the day that the Dow dropped almost 1,600 points intraday, it was up. The ISM services for January showed it ticked back up to around 59.9, so almost 60, versus 56 in December. That was the revised number for December. There's also been some talk this week, as I mentioned, investors are adjusting to higher rates given the hourly wage inflation numbers we've been seeing have been ticking up. So that's happening on economics, but that's typically a good sign. Typically, towards the end of a bull market, you see interest rates go up, representing a healthy, growing economy. So we're finally, John, seeing that. It hasn't been happening for the last 3 years, 2 years, 6 months. It just started happening again. Another thing I want to mention that, recall last week I mentioned the Federal Open Market Committee statement was reasonable, given that the PCE inflation numbers showed year over year, inflation's up only 1.5%. That's still well below their target. So what's interesting here during this correction is that we didn't see treasury yields crater, a huge flock to treasuries. Didn't see it. Didn't see it into gold. Didn't see it into the dollar. That's the safety trade. Didn't happen. The dollar is up 2% this week. Okay. Big wow with the market down almost 11% at the bottom. Gold is down almost 1.5% this week. So that's not the big exodus that we would probably want to see if we're talking about more fundamentals were happening, an economic issue, a currency issue, and just not seeing that. So earnings fine this week. Certain individual companies got hit. On the whole, I was looking at the numbers. This has been a breakout quarter, the fourth quarter in sales surprises over the past 3 years. So, I mean, when that kind of stuff happens, that's not what happens at a market top. You start to see some sectors lag. We're just not seeing that yet.
So at this time, given everything that's going on, Ryan, what is Financial Sense Wealth Management doing?
Well, John, we have not been 100% in equities for the past year. So we've underperformed last year, but here's where we're shining. We had had, and we had raised cash from rebalancing last month. We have between cash and bonds, depending on the objective of the portfolio, anywhere from 20% between the two, cash and bonds, to as high as 40 and 50% for our more conservative investors. Chris deployed about a quarter of what we had in cash on Tuesday, and then he deployed another quarter on Friday when we hit that 200-day average on the S&P. We still have about another half. We do plan to buy into this dip because we're bulls, and we like the earnings outlook. We like the economic outlook. None of our risk indicators are saying warning. In fact, just the opposite. Our risk indicators are saying we're in crisis mode already, and that's typically when you start seeing bottoms. So like I said, we've been buying this dip. We had the mentality about a month ago that things were a little elevated, so we raised some cash a little bit ahead of time. You know, nobody knows the exact bottom. So when we get those big dips, we were down almost 10%, I think, on Tuesday morning. You know, we start putting some money to work. So again, we're of that buy the dip mentality, and where we're going right now is we're following the business cycle. We're going to late stage business cycle areas of the market, like inflation sensitive areas. And, I don't think that we're going to be looking at runaway inflation right now. But if you look at the areas that have been doing well, that are holding, from what I've been watching intraday, looking at the rallies that we've been seeing all the week, I'm seeing a lot of money going into stocks that haven't had these nice run-ups. Retail, I talked about retail in December with huge year-over-year increases in the sales rates of where things are, and that still looks like an area that we like. We like energy, we like materials, and foreign equities. So we've been putting money in emerging markets and more in foreign markets through this purchase program that we're doing right now.
So generally then, what are we looking forward to? A peaceful week next week? Or are we sliding into a new paradigm here? I mean, I wouldn't want you to miss your nap.
No, volatility is definitely here, and that is the norm. We are, and I think we have Craig Johnson on the show later on, don't we, for the technician? And he's been pretty spot on his calls. I've been listening and reading some of his work early this week, as among others. I have a couple of technical analysts I've followed that believe we're looking at a 20% correction. I think Craig Johnson's one of them. A couple of others that we also follow believe that this was it, that we bought them on Monday, is what one of them has said to me. So we're in a corrective mode. Corrective modes can operate in two different functions. We can be fast and furious on the downside, which is so far what we've been experiencing, or it could be long and drawn out like we saw in 2015 until we hit that low in 2016. That was over the course of like almost a full year where the market really didn't go anywhere, and we actually developed a top going into that February correction of 2016. So where are we right now? Next week, is it going to be calm? We hit some major numbers. You know, the 200-day average, the VIX had spiked today on Friday. I don't believe the VIX was as high as it was on Tuesday. So we've hit some panic levels, and that's typically when we have seen some bottoms in the past. However, you know, I was watching on Friday, and I kept going back and forth with Chris, 2620. That was a number I was watching very closely. We could not close above it, so we could come back down and retest the 200-day average again on Monday. So it's anyone's best guess at this point. The crystal ball is cloudy.
Yep, indeed it is. All right, Ryan Poplava, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, as we've seen this last week, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
A little over a year ago, we started seeing these longer leading indicators moving up, and it was the brightest global growth outlook we'd seen since 2010. And of course, 2010 was the recovery out of the Great Recession, so that was a pretty good recovery then. And what we've had in 2016 into 17 was the brightest we'd seen since then. And everybody knows that history now. Of course, the leading indicators, they don't get too caught up in today's headlines. They're always looking ahead. And they've gone and turned again, both for the United States and for the global economy. The growth rates of our long leading indicators have turned down. And that tells us that the synchronized global growth upturn that we've all been kind of enjoying last year is drawing to a close and, in fact, may already be over.
Well, it seemed like a broken record since the beginning of the year. Every single week, the market would head higher and break new records. Well, that all changed a little over a week ago. Now, the market's down for the year, having given back all of its gains. Is this the start of something more ominous? Joining us on the program from Piper Jaffray is Craig Johnson. Craig, let's take a look at the market. You recently called for the S&P to drop to 2,400 from its high of 2,872 and the Dow to drop to 22,000. What's behind this drop, in your opinion, and why do you believe it's going there?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. In our piece that we had published in the mid part of January, we wrote a report. We titled it A Hop, A Drop, and A Pop. And that's how we think 2018 is going to play out. We feel good about our 2850 objective on the S&P 500 for the year, but we don't believe it's going to be made in a linear manner like we had seen back in 2017. And here's why. Number one, we're concerned about rising interest rates. When you go back and you look at 10-year bond yields, 30-year bond yields, even the 5-year bond yields here in the U.S., 5-year bond yields, you're at 10-year new highs in this. The long end of the curve hasn't quite gone up a lot at this point in time, but I think it's almost like a bit of a springboard where you may see a quick, sharp adjustment higher in rates, which is indeed happening right now, and we may be at closer to a 3% 10-year bond yield sooner than we probably realize. Here's the problem with that, though. We've got a weaker dollar happening internationally, which hurts international investors of our debt. You're seeing principal losses coming in, so they're getting cut on both currency and also on principal losses on the fixed income side. That's concerning to me. But the last couple times when you look back, we've had these quick, sharp adjustments up in rates. You were back in 2004, 5, somewhere in that vicinity. You also had it during the taper tantrum. And people don't realize this, but in 87, you had a pretty sharp adjustment upwards before the market did a pretty good, quick reset. So that's kind of the number one concern. The number two concern, Jim, is the fact that if I look at the names in the Dow, I can see that stocks like Caterpillar, Boeing, Microsoft, Amazon's not in the Dow, but Amazon, Microsoft, Goldman, a lot of these charts have gone parabolic. And in a technical world, charts that go parabolic go straight up, almost look like they're going to bend over backwards. Those are not sustainable price advances. I have got no problem with the fundamentals for any of these companies, Boeing, Caterpillar, Microsoft, or Amazon. But I do know, Jim, that parabolic advances do not correct in time. They typically correct in price, and they usually correct about 110% of the advance that they go through. So my problem really is not fundamentals for this market, maybe valuation to a degree, but there's just a lot of very good companies that don't look like good stocks to me right now. And that concerns me. And that's why I don't want to step up. And that's why we wrote the report in January, calling for a more serious setback and a reset of the market at this point. And as you know, we have been very positive on this market since 2012.
You know, Craig, when you're talking about the numbers that you're referring to, 2,400 on the S&P, 22,000 on the Dow, that gets us in the vicinity of 20% correction in the market. Now, we have these rules out there in the market. Whenever the market drops 20%, it's called a bear market or we're in a bear market. What's your opinion on that figure?
You know, those terms are terms that I've used, we've talked about over the years, but I think we got to step back and distinguish between, is this a longer-term secular bear market, or is this just kind of a setback bear market, right? As I think about this, there's no question that the longer-term secular bull market thesis that we've long talked about here on this show is still very much intact. And I still think the secular bull market lasts until you get to a 5 or 6% 10-year bond yield. That being said, we have had corrections and bear markets in the context of secular bull markets in the past. Think about 87 as an example. You had that very big drop, and you almost recovered all of the gains by the end of the year. So I guess my point is, I don't want to get too hung up on classification of pullback, correction, bear market, when we got to put it into the context of, I think, the bigger trend out there. And that's why I've been trying to call this more of a resetting of investor expectations, because, again, these stocks in the Dow have gotten to be so parabolic in my perspective. And when I look at it and I say 14, 15% of the weight of the Dow has gone parabolic, I don't need to buy that. I can wait for it to come in.
Yeah, because you have some of these big cap stocks. One comes to mind is Boeing, where it virtually has doubled in almost a 12-month period of time. Likewise, as you mentioned, Microsoft. So in your opinion, is this more of a technical backdrop that is causing this? And what about volatility and how that plays into here? Because there were a lot of stories about a couple of volatility funds that just blew up on Monday. And how much of that is factoring into this downturn?
Well, I think some of those volatility funds blowing up, there could have been some hedging that has gotten done or used as hedges for some investors out there. But I guess what to me is, it's more of a sign of a reemergence of volatility. It's a sign that, you know, maybe not everything is perfect as everybody had previously believed. I think it's been more of a reason for people to take some profits. But again, I think more importantly, the two drivers are, you got an interesting combination of stocks that are pretty extended, and you got rates that are going up very quickly. So again, ultimately, rates going up should lead to an asset allocation shift from fixed income to equities. But I come back and I think about the good people on your show, and if you've got losses in fixed income, the market near all-time new highs, I just don't think that's a natural switch out of one into another. I think there's going to be an intermediary step in there, which is, I'm going to take some out of my bonds, I'm going to sit in cash, see if this market comes in, and then at that point in time, I think you'll have a better buying opportunity, and I think that's going to be the mentality for people. But at this point in time, I feel like you've got further reset to go before we get down to a levels that are going to be, I think, attractive enough for people.
You know, you bring up something that you and I have discussed in the past, and that is with rising rates, a lot of money after the financial recession that we saw between 2007 and 2009, a lot of individual investors, the vast majority of those inflows went into bond funds. It's kind of like a no-brainer. They were in search of higher yield. They wanted something that was safe. And pretty much, Craig, for 8 or 9 years, that was the place to be. But if you look at something like a popular ETF like TLT, where it was up to 128, I mean, it's down to 118. So these people are feeling as much pain as stock investors are, if not more.
Right. And that's why I want to get the message out there to people that they need to be careful, you know, with their fixed income portfolios. There's a lot of great retired people that have worked hard over the years. And, you know, they've piled into some of these fixed income funds thinking that there could never be any losses. We've been in a declining rate environment for 36 years. Well, now that we've moved through 260, 270 on the 10-year, Jim, we've reversed a 36-year, again, I repeat, a 36-year downtrend in rates. That is meaningful, and that cannot be ignored. We are now in a rising rate environment, and I've always said, and I've said this many times on the show, if this market's going to stumble, it's going to have a problem, it's going to have an issue, I don't necessarily know what it is. I wouldn't have guessed that with the XIV and the short volatility funds basically imploding, that that was going to be the consequence. But I just know that I don't know how you reverse a 36-year downtrend. You don't get a momentum response in rates and something doesn't break. And that's where my chief concern is. I don't know what's going to break. You're at one indication, that short volatility fund, but there may be other things that are going to get broken because we haven't seen rising rates in 36 years. This is the biggest technical change that I will probably see in my lifetime.
Yeah, because for most of our working career, we have been witness to a decline in interest rates. I can remember my first mortgage at 9% and then mortgage rates going all the way up to 12 and 13% compared to where they are today, closer to 4. Craig, I want to talk about market leadership. When you go through a phase, as we're going through now, this corrective phase, as you're calling it, when you go through a downturn like this, does leadership change coming out of it? Are you looking for the same stocks that led us all the way up to be the same stocks that lead us out of this?
Well, in secular changes in the market, for instance, coming up until 2000, it was led by technology. From 2000 up until 2013, 14, it was all about energy stocks. You had clear indications of leadership in those kind of changes. I think coming out of this setback that I think is already beginning and winding up, I think you're going to see financials probably do very well because I think you'll ultimately will get a steepening of the curve. So I think the financial sector will be a good place to go. I'm seeing more institutional money stepping into some of these kind of bigger, safer financial names. I would also say that everything the administration has done, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, just be made aware that, number one, we need to invest our money to invest our money, and we need to set aside any sort of other political agendas or beliefs or ideologies. We're here to invest for retirement. But at the end of the day, everything is inflationary, and that's not a bad thing. Because we do need the yield curve to steepen. We do need to see some wage inflation. We need to see these things start to unfold. So we need to be thinking about inflation plays coming out of this. Financials fit into this. I think your basic materials will probably do well coming out of this. And if we do get an infrastructure play or a bill or a package that gets put together by the administration, I would think that those basic material stocks, whether it's steel stocks, copper stocks, those kind of areas will probably do well coming out of this too.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this inflationary impact. We just had a massive tax cut that is going into effect this year, and it's front end loaded. The administration is now talking about $1 trillion infrastructure program that they're about to unveil. The Senate just put together a budget. Of course, it hasn't passed the House yet, but that would increase spending by another $300 billion. Craig, in the next 2 years, we're going to be looking at $1 trillion deficits again.
Absolutely, and that's on top of already $20 trillion in debt for the country the way it is now. So ultimately, this probably means a little bit weaker for the dollar and probably means a higher long end of the curve. I mean, that will likely be the outcome from this. And as we go through this process of shifting from a downward trending rate environment to a rising rate environment, people are going to have to rethink their investments. They're going to have to think about, okay, maybe I need to own more equities and less fixed income in this environment going forward as inflation might become a bigger challenge for them, or they need to take the duration of their bond portfolio down. So this is going to lead to some shifts and some dislocations, and we need to stay nimble. We need to stay ready for those changes and definitely be reaching out to your advisors and talk about this. Don't ignore them.
Yeah, this is something that you're raising that I think is going to be a big shock for a lot of our listeners. And that is, you know, for, as you mentioned, the last 36 years, all we've experienced is falling interest rates. In fact, we got to the lowest point in recorded human history, where you had almost one third of sovereign debt, actually negative yields, where you paid the government to loan them money. And I can remember, Craig, when I got in the business, we used to call bonds certificates of confiscation because rising interest rates, we had the 10-year note at 15.8% back in 1981. And if you were a bond investor in the late 60s and the 70s, you lost money just about every single year. I don't know if people are really prepared for such a dramatic shift in the investment environment.
Jim, terrific point, and I do not believe that they are. I think they've got too complacent. And they haven't realized that a couple different things. One, bonds kind of trade by appointment. They're not as liquid as what you have with equities and other kinds of instruments. And I think when people do try to come make these asset allocation shifts and changes, it's going to be a little bit more challenging than they realize to get these realignments ultimately done and completed. And if you're a retired individual and you're going to be, you know, living and utilizing the returns from these bond portfolios, duration has got to come down on them. And unfortunately, right now, the returns are not terrific. So equities and dividend-paying stocks ultimately become a better choice.
So, Craig, let's take this individual investors, because a lot of them are out there in bond funds. I think I read somewhere a little over a trillion something has gone into these bond funds, which, as you and I know, have no definite maturity. What would you advise somebody that's in a bond fund, and let's say somebody that's retired, relying on income and has a good bulk of their net worth in these bond funds, thinking they're perfectly safe?
Well, I think they have to go back and rethink these bond funds, number one, but also they need to have a conversation, a real conversation with their advisor. I mean, everybody's situation is a little bit different and their risk tolerance is all a little bit different. So it'd be very difficult to make a broad sweeping statement here on the show as to, you know, how everybody should ultimately position. That's really a conversation they need to have with their advisor, but I suspect it means probably a little bit of dialing back ultimately some of that fixed income exposure and probably increasing some of your equity exposure is what that probably means, Jim. But again, a better conversation for your advisor and a great reason to reach out to them.
Craig, let's talk about, as you mentioned, we talked about deficits are going to probably get back up into the trillion-dollar range. Interest rates are rising, a falling dollar. Much of this is all going to be inflationary. What position does that put the Fed in, given the fact that they're sitting on a ton of bonds that they may have to liquidate? And with rates rising as they are, can this market handle, let's say, three more rate hikes this year and several next year?
You know, Jim, that is the ultimate crux of the question that we're trying to ultimately answer. And as we go through this rising rate environment, perhaps something is going to break. Not sure I know exactly what it is, but again, 36-year downtrend reversal. In terms of deficit and the government, you know, they could ride these bonds into perpetuity, right? End of maturity. They don't have to necessarily redeem these things, and nor does the Fed have to show any sort of loss or gain on those bonds either. And that's not necessarily a big problem from them from that perspective. So I'm less worried about that. I just think that the issuance of debt may become more costly for them as some of this paper does need to get rolled over, and we do need to pay attention to that. I mean, leaving our kids with $20 trillion or $22 trillion or $21 trillion in debt doesn't seem like something that we should ultimately do. But we do need to get this economy working. We do need to create more jobs for great people here in America, and we do need to get that part of the economy working.
I want to get back to your inflation thesis. If we're heading in an inflation environment, which it certainly appears to, with the falling dollar, rising deficits, and of course, increased government stimulus, you mentioned inflation. Where does gold and, let's say, energy, which are commodities and inflationary asset, where do they play in this scenario?
Well, right now we are overweight. We've been overweight tech. We've been overweight basic materials. We've been overweight energy. I would think that energy basics have not been, well, feeling a lot of love from a lot of investors lately and hadn't been up until recently showing, you know, improving relative performance in the marketplace. So I think ultimately from a sector level perspective, those are going to be some decent areas to be in. My only challenge I have with gold right now is I'm waiting on the charts to see some sort of move above about 1400 on gold. I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking for it. Hasn't happened yet. But maybe with some further market volatility, we are going to get, you know, a pickup and a little bit of demand for gold in here. And perhaps with some of the millennials, maybe Bitcoin becomes an option for them instead of gold. Who knows? We'll see.
So given this changing environment, what would you advise investors to do? Let's say if they're in stocks right now, good quality stocks, would you hold given where you think things are going in the future? And then also, let's say somebody that's in a bond.
At this point in time, I think always having a little bit of cash, a little bit of dry powder available to take advantage of some of these dislocations makes sense to me. And again, I'd go back to your advisor and kind of get a comfort level as to, you know, what makes sense for each individual's, you know, risk tolerance and parameters. In terms of bonds versus equities, I favor equities over bonds at this point in time, because I do think that the rising interest rate environment is going to continue, and we are going to continue to see 10, 30-year, and 5-year bonds move higher. And I think the principal risk, if you need to have that money before the maturities occur, is, well, not going to give you a great real return. So, again, equities over bonds from my perspective, Jim.
So, given this pullback you are seeing or forecasting, if we were having this conversation December 31st of this year, where would you expect the S&P to be at this point?
Yeah, Jim. So I think that end of the year, we're going to be at 2850. What I'm saying is that there's a high probability of a shorter term dislocation in this market. I want to be buying that dislocation. So we do need to have some powder available, but I'm looking at 2850 at year end. I'm not questioning corporate America fundamentals at this point in time. I'm questioning the parabolic advance. How much of this news is already baked into these stocks is what I'm questioning, and why I think this market resets itself and we get a better opportunity to buy stocks. Well, frankly, perhaps in the spring or perhaps in the summer to buy stocks. Not now, but 2850, I feel pretty comfortable with that number at year end. And, you know, be ready for the setbacks and be ready to be nimble. Talk to your advisor and be ready to put some money to work on a pullback.
Craig, well, listen, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, they can reach me at my email address of craig.w.johnson@pjc.com.
Do you know what everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Surprising to me how nice everybody is to Chair Yellen as she leaves office, because she's probably the most radical Fed chair we've ever had. And everybody congratulates her for what she did. But I think she's left Chairman Powell a terrible mess to clean up with the Fed's portfolio, is it will take a long time for those Fannie Mae securities that they bought to run off, a lot longer than they think.
Well, after nearly hitting close to $70 a barrel, the price of oil has pulled back sharply. We're now approaching the lower $60 level. Is this anything to be concerned about, and what does this mean for energy stocks? Joining me on the program is energy analyst Kurt Wolf. Kurt, let's talk about the price of oil. There was a buildup in inventories recently that was larger than expected, so you had a big sell-off in the market. The commercials have gone heavily short, and a lot of the spec money has been coming out of this market. So let's talk about the fundamentals. What are driving these prices where they are right now?
Well, always talking about stuff's quite good with economic growth around the world. No indication of any change in the acceleration that's taken place in recent months. On the supply side, we are getting a lot more oil out of the U.S. than we might have traditionally. With this kind of a demand outlook, you'd see prices a lot higher, but we're not surprised that they're not higher because the shale oil has been coming on like gangbusters. We're up to over 10 million barrels a day now in the U.S., which is up several million barrels a day in a very short period of time. So our U.S. supply responds quickly, and we're as big a producer as Saudi Arabia and Russia, practically. And that's the change in the oil outlook. Otherwise, the pressures for higher prices are strong normally, but they're dampened by the rapid increase in supply, which, of course, that's good for everybody in a way. The price doesn't get out of sight, and the producers who are producing more oil make more money on the volume side, as long as they don't get too much volume and drive the price down. But we're holding pretty well here at 60s, right on the, pretty close to the 200-day average. So it could very well be a point for continued progress over time.
You know, Kurt, something that we're going to see this year, oil production in the U.S. exceed that of Saudi Arabia. You've been in this industry for a long time. Would you have ever thought, since our oil production peaked back in the early 70s, you would see a day that the U.S. would revive again and exceed the production of Saudi Arabia?
No, that's for sure. That's a humbling experience. It tells us how much we know about the future, how much we think we know about the future, but it's also it's a very exciting development. I know we never would have thought this. We were definitely in a supply scarcity frame of mind up until the mid-2000s when fracking came along on natural gas, and then it was applied to oil as well. It's exciting.
And the other thing that this has done is, from a geopolitical shift, it's changed the outcome of OPEC, because at one time, OPEC was this monolithic organization that can direct the price of oil in either direction it wanted to. Now, they have to contend with U.S. shale producers.
Yeah, it's disruptive. We live in, that's probably an overused word, but it's a good one. It says that things are not going to be the same in the future as they've been in the past.
And what does this say about future oil spikes? Because as we were approaching closer to that $70 range, of course, production is ramping up in the U.S., which means more supply coming to the market. And we're still working off some of those inventories, Kurt. So it doesn't seem like, at least at the moment, we're at risk of an oil shock.
Nor do I think we're at risk of an oil shock in either direction. $70 is my long-term price, so we're gradually moving up there, and at 70, we can go for quite a while on a balanced situation.
You know, something that has been associated with just about every single recession that we've seen coming out of World War II has been a spike in oil prices. There was a professor here out of San Diego that just did a paper on oil shocks going back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, and every single period where we've seen a huge spike in energy, we've seen a recession. And if you take a look at the price of oil, we got down to almost $26 a barrel back in the early part of 2016. Kurt, here we are at $60 a barrel. So in essence, prices have more than doubled, but the economy is still rolling along and it's still very strong. So it hasn't impacted the economy. Have we adjusted? I guess after $100 oil, I guess we can live with $60 oil.
That's right. We didn't like $100 as consumers, but 60 looks pretty good, and other things are up too. Inflation's up a little bit, so my $70 is still a decent price for consumers, and it's one where producers make quite a bit of money. But producers can get along at 60, and they can survive at 50 if they have to. I just think that on a long-term basis, that business has to be healthy, not scraping along. And of course, as far as the oil shock theory goes, that's the great thing of the shale oil. It will dampen any shock. There may not be a shock because of all the new shale supply.
And Kurt, let's talk about the shale producers themselves. We're seeing Exxon just announced that they're going to invest $50 billion in the U.S. They're going very heavily into the shale plays in Texas. At one time, I heard it was, you know, shale producers needed $60, $70 oil. What is the break-even point for shale production at this point?
Well, at 60, 70 has been improved upon by technology. Technology keeps getting better. I think there's a thought now, though, that some companies make money at $40 a barrel, or they could break even temporarily at a lower price. But the whole industry is not in that position. And to some extent, we tend to drill the best stuff first so that the prime areas are being drilled. Well, in the secondary area, maybe we get more technological improvement to offset the fact that the secondary areas aren't quite as good as the primary areas to start with. But I think it's a good balanced situation, you know, that price won't be too high, but it won't be much lower than the current level either.
So as we look at this, and let's talk about where we are right now with demand. We know that global growth is expected to be stronger this year. Growth in the U.S., growth in Europe and around the globe, which means more demand for oil. One thing the IEA has consistently done is up their demand. I think this year demand is supposed to go up by another 1.3 million barrels. So we're approaching now 99 million barrels a day of consumption on that basis. But let's talk about the seasonality of oil, because we have a couple times of the year where refineries kind of shut down for routine maintenance. We have weather-related items, like, for example, in the fall, the weather is nice. You're coming off the summer driving season. Let's talk about where we are now, because we're entering a sort of a weak period for demand for energy just ahead of the summer driving season.
Yeah, that's what the people in the industry like to call the shoulder months, the spring and the fall, where there's not a lot of demand for heating energy, there's not a lot of demand for air conditioning energy, and the summer driving season hasn't started yet. But if I were to cut through that, oil and gas stocks have often peaked in the springtime. So I don't think we're peaking now, because the winter is still with us, and demand is strong, and gasoline demand has been good. So I think we're looking at a pretty good summer season. The oil stocks keep going until July or August. If the driving season is really good, then they don't peak until the end of the driving season. But the fall is usually quiet, and then that's a good time to be buying for the winter ahead. But at the same time, we've had a pretty sharp drop in the market. So I think you got to look at the stocks right now on a long-term basis. Something like, I won't say about any particular stocks yet. But you know, I think that the point that we haven't been covering here, the great concern in the broader marketplace about rising inflation. You can see it in the implied inflation rate in the U.S. 10-year note. It's gone from about 1.7% to 2.1% in the last few weeks. And we've got all this debate in Washington about the government spending versus taxation. The lower taxes are going to drive demand very nicely, but we're also spending a lot more, so our deficit is going up. And so we're getting noises of rising inflation, rising interest rates. In the 70s, that was a great outlook for oil. Oil did very well in the high interest rates in the 70s. In the 90s, interest rates went up a little bit in 1994, but the stock market had a great time during the 90s. We're concerned about inflation, so I like the idea of having overweighted in oil to protect against inflation. But at the same time, I'm not sure that the market's going to be all that weak yet either, or that interest rates will go up all that fast. So that's, of course, you don't have to ask me for those forecasts. Nobody knows those results anyway. But I think a diversified portfolio with a little extra oil in it for inflation protection, and a pretty good chunk in the stock market for growth, and a pretty good chunk in short-term debt securities for protection is a very solid basis to keep investing.
Kurt, I want to talk about some of the oil stocks. Typically, when the market pulls back or you have a sell-off, the big blue-chip names hold up the best because they have strong dividends, they have strong balance sheets, they're market leaders. That has not happened this time. You've seen some severe pullbacks, drops of almost 15% in such big stocks like Exxon and Chevron. What explains that to you? Because it seems like it's an overreaction. I know that analysts were a little bit disappointed on some of the earnings, but they didn't miss by much.
The earnings doesn't help explain why the stocks are so weak, I don't believe. But I think if you go back 5-10 years or so, we used to think that the big stocks wouldn't go down that much, and the little stocks would suffer the most. And then that can be the case too from time to time. But in recent years, we're seeing a little different pattern, and we saw it again very strongly here recently. I don't know how to explain it except to say that when there's a lot of selling pressure in the market, people look at what they can sell. It's safe in our energy stocks, for example. Some of my little guys are really beaten down. Birchcliff and Range, for example. I wouldn't sell Birchcliff and Range here, but if I had to raise some money, I might peel off a little bit of Exxon. That's the kind of reasoning that you can't sell Birchcliff and Range because they're already down a lot, but you can sell a stock that is pretty solid and held up, and you can get close to the price that you want for it. So I think it's a source of liquidity for investors under stress, but I don't know that for a fact. I just have that sense.
So as you look at this overreaction, do you think this is a result of indexing? Because I know when you sell an index fund, whether it's an S&P, the Spiders, or an ETF, one of the big market cap stocks in that index is, of course, stocks like Chevron, stocks like Exxon, which are in the Dow itself. So do you think this is a part behind this steep decline? Because, I mean, if you look at the charts, I mean, whether you're looking at Exxon or Chevron, it looked like it fell off the cliff.
Yeah, right. Exxon down to the lower point of the last 2 years. Chevron's still above the 200-day average. I looked at the XLE. XLE is the oil and gas component of the Standard & Poor's 500, and it has dropped right to the 200-day average. So that should be, on a momentum basis, that should be a buy point. Of course, no guarantee to be buy point. Exxon went smashing through the 200-day average, and they're now at the low end of the range. Whatever it is, the 200-day average has been a pretty decent source of value for these companies. So if you can buy the stocks at the 200-day average or below it, that's generally a pretty nice long-term commitment. My MacDep ratios are down quite a bit here, along with the stock prices. So if you're a long-term investor, this is a good time. It wasn't very long ago that stock prices were way up. You could see that the stock prices were way above the 50-day average, and they're beginning to go, at least for the market as a whole, beginning to go parabolic here in the last couple of weeks. So there are times when the market pulls back for one reason or another, and we've obviously had that.
You know, Kurt, what is it about the energy industry that you always see it go to extremes, whether you look at what happened between 1998 and 2000 when the price of oil tripled. If you take a look at where it got down in 2016, down to $26 a barrel, and here we are above 60. And of course, the extremes that we really saw was between 2007 and 2008, where the price of oil went from 50 to almost 150. It's always going in one extreme or the other. Either prices are dropping, falling off cliff, like we just mentioned with some of these big cap stocks, or it's going parabolic. It doesn't ever seem to be anything in between.
It is a volatile commodity, and in a sense, commodities look pretty good here if we're worried about inflation and rising interest rates. And because we have high demand means more demand for commodities than upward pressures on prices. So commodities are part of the contribution, you might say, to inflation. And if you're invested in commodities like oil and gas, you're holding even and in a good company. You're ahead of the game. So it is volatile. I think we can get a sense when it's very low and it's very high. So just like we talked about the market itself just a few minutes ago, but when you're really way up there, that's the time to sell something if you can. But when you're really down, like we're now in Exxon, this is not a time to sell Exxon. This is a time to buy Exxon again. Earlier, I wasn't told you to sell it either. So Exxon's not up a lot, and it's a very solid investment.
Yeah, it seems like an overreaction here. So as you look at the energy sector, as you look at your MacDep ratios, which evaluate present value of oil streams coming from these companies, you follow mid-tier, large cap stocks, and then some of the smaller ones. Where are the best MacDep ratios right now in your universe?
Well, the best MacDep ratios are on the highest risk stocks, some of the small independents. And it turns out that the MacDep ratios are pretty low on the big integrated companies right now, which is a little bit of a surprise. There have been times when they've been high. So what we're saying about Exxon, I think, is timely. One of my best performing stock last year and this year, has moved up a little bit in MacDep ratio. Those are the small cap income payers. They pay about 8% typically, and they're still up this year. But boy, you put most of your money in the big integrated companies because they're the most secure, and right now their prices are quite attractive. Then you put next to most of your money in the large cap E&P companies. Most of them are all doing reasonably well. Pioneer just reported yesterday they're on a 20% a year growth curve, or they got a huge shale oil position. And the small independents, there are a couple of them, like there's Continental Resources, which is an excellent oil shale company. Then there's some natural gas plays like Range Resources and Birchcliff, as I mentioned. They look like they're going off the cliff, as you say. And, of course, I don't believe that they are. When the natural gas situation will turn around is hard to say, but we haven't really been this depressed for quite a while. Maybe you'll make more money in these small cap independents, but they're the higher risk. They've got the lowest MacDep ratios, but the two stocks that I mentioned are also high debt stocks. So that would make you wary in a rising interest rate environment. But the income stocks that I mentioned, the small cap income stocks, they're no debt stocks. Then they pay out all of their cash flow. So they're theoretically more secure, although as small stocks, depending on the marketplace, small stocks can be under a lot of price pressure from time to time. But, Exxon is a good choice. EOG is the top quality company. ConocoPhillips is a lower MacDep ratio large cap company.
Well, anytime you see a steep drop, as you're seeing today, of course, if you're a long-term investor, always presents an opportunity. Listen, Kurt, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the research that you do, tell them how they can find you.
My research is available on mcdep.com, M-C-D-E-P, that's David Edward Peter. I send my research to my clients first, and then after a couple of weeks, I put it up for public access on mcdep.com. And you're welcome to use it as much as you want when it's on the website.
From reaching record levels in January, stock prices have plunged globally, not just stock prices. It's almost every asset class from stocks and bonds and commodities. And it's quite a drop off from the January highs where there was a tremendous amount of euphoria. And it's all happened in just about a week. As a matter of fact, oil prices are down as well. Gold is down. Interest rates, normally a safe haven, have remained stubbornly high. So wherever you look, there seems to be blood in the streets. Now, the real question is, so the question remains, is this the beginning of a recession? Is it simply a correction? But is it also a paradigm shift into a new operating environment? All of that, the subject of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.